welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you're listening to episode 112 of The Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Have you ever met somebody after all your friends have already met them and find yourself wondering, why the heck didn't you meet this person already? Well, that's today's guest. She's been a part of the film-going community here in Toronto for some time, and somehow I always sat on the other end of the table. And that's a shame, because not only is she super smart and super charming, but she's also a formidable debate opponent, as we will demonstrate in this episode later on. She writes at Row 3 and likewise at RoomWorg, also keeping up her own little fishbowl at arielfisher.com, right?
Correct.
Cool, look at me doing my homework. And she's joining us here at Casa del McNeil. We are joined by Ariel Fisher. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Even better now after that lovely introduction.
I do try to craft them to get them just so. So thank you for coming out on a weeknight. And Skip, you were going to skip X-Men for a few moments there.
I was definitely going to, and then
the decision was made for you.
It slipped out of my mind, and then it re-entered my mind due to forceful coaxing from a couple of people, and then the reality of being able to attend became a non-reality. So here you are.
I'm really Plan B. It's okay. I'm secure with that station. One little note before we get into the show. I'm experimenting with using SoundCloud as a distribution platform. So if you do use that and you want to use it to catch the show, go to soundcloud.com/matineecast and you can get the most recent episode. Hey, if it works, I will actually pony up some money and put more episodes on there, but we'll see how that goes. But yeah, if you use SoundCloud or use the SoundCloud app, give that a shot. It's the end of May, which means we've arrived at my birthday, and that brings way to the birthday show. The custom is to talk about an old favorite in lieu of reviewing a new release, usually because the new releases around this time of year kind of suck. So in keeping with the tradition, today we will be discussing Raiders of the Lost Ark. We'll be fielding feedback on double features and turning the record over to play the other side. Before that, though, we need to learn about Ariel. This is Know Your Enemy. Alright, so you actually have no idea how any of this goes. This is, I don't know why I'm excited to say this, but Ariel doesn't listen to my show. This is all coming to her, like, you know, fresh. But what is the first film you can remember seeing in a theater?
The first film I ever saw in theaters, which I know because of being told, was Home Alone when I was two.
Okay.
And apparently I cried every time.
Well, it's because it's a bad movie.
No, what?
We're not going to start this yet. We're not going to start yet.
You just know.
But yes.
I
will go to the mat for that one. That is a bad film.
Are you prepared for your show to be 3 hours? Because we got time.
I've had this argument over and over. I have married into a family that adores it, and I just don't get it.
Like it, or you legitimately think it is bad?
I legitimately think it is bad. And here's the thing: I liked it when I was a kid, and then I watched it, as a grown up, and I was like, "What is this? In all facets?"
Do you hate John Hughes?
No, I love John Hughes. I just hate that movie.
Why?
Because he does nothing but scream. They do nothing but scream. The plot is ludicrous. And it's everybody just gives it a blind pass because he's a cute kid. And he's not even that cute of a kid.
He was a pretty adorable child, but either way.
He kind of looks like a monkey with a blonde wig.
But to say that it's a ludicrous concept is, I mean, come on. Lord of the Rings is a pretty ludicrous concept. It's,
right, but we're already very ludicrous by that point. We're in a world where there are elves
and dwarves.
So
there's a barometer for your level of acceptance of ludicrousness?
Absolutely.
But
how did it go when you went to see Home Alone as a two-year-old?
Apparently, I cried every time the burglars were on screen.
It's because your tasteometer was already developing.
No, it was because they scared me. They did their job. And I have rewatched it time and time again. In fact, it was playing for Christmas this year. It was playing at the Blue Ridge
Cinema. Oh, I know.
Yeah. And it was it was my first time seeing it on the big screen since I was two.
Okay.
The other story is not of the first film that I saw in theaters, but of the first film that I watched ever.
Okay.
I was 2 months old.
Oh.
My dad it was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was crying and screaming, and my mom said, "You take her." So my dad got up and picked me up and took me downstairs and turned on the TV and found like old back episodes of I Love Lucy and all sorts of nice stuff. And then he settled on Platoon. And within a few minutes of gunshots firing and explosions going off, I was out like a light.
That's awesome.
Which explains a lot, actually. It's very strange, but yeah.
That's, okay. That, like, I saw that one when I was a little bit too young, actually. Those are the kind of movies like my parents used to rent. And and worse than that, I watched those on like TV when they were like censored for TV.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know. I might have been like 9 the first time I saw that. Which, like, don't get me wrong, like, there's nothing in there that I don't think your average 9-year-old probably couldn't handle, especially the TV edit.
Yeah.
But it's just a little too young for that. Certainly 2 months, I think. Then you're just not getting any of it. Then it's just, like, flashing lights.
Exactly. You have no sense of perception of anything. And the white noise of the bullets, apparently, was the perfect lullaby.
What was the last film you watched?
Chef.
Oh, okay. That's the new one that's coming out with Jon Favreau, right?
Yep, written and directed by as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's. I was wondering about him after how he'd ever recover from Cowboys and Aliens. How is Chef? Like
Chef
for as much as you're allowed to say.
Well, it's good. It's a little bloated and it kind of needs to trim the fat. But it's
how long is it?
If I remember, I think it's over an hour and a half.
Oh, okay.
It's, I think...
Okay, so yeah, and that struck me as a movie that should be, like, 100 minutes or less.
And it's around that, but in terms of the content, it's just... The wrong things are allocated a little bit too much time, and the right things are kind of skimmed over, but...
Okay.
That aside, it's a ton of fun. It's really pleasant to watch. It's just a pleasurable experience. Don't go and see it without a reservation for food anywhere.
Yeah, I love movies. Like I love movies where there's a lot of attention paid to food. Like,
oh,
you know,
there's
like,
attention
okay,
paid to
good,
food.
Okay, good. Like Eat, Drink, Man, Woman or Big Night. Like these movies are like crack to me. I find that does not happen nearly enough in cinema, and I don't know why.
It's almost like the culinary version of dance films.
Yeah,
like
that's exactly what it is.
It's decadent. There isn't necessarily a ton of substance to it, but it's so just delicious.
Waitress, it's the one with Carrie Russell, where she's the...
I haven't seen it.
But okay, it's
I know
slight.
It,
it's not deep. It's not deep theater at all. And but she pays so much attention through the course of the movie to making these little pies, and it's just like, you know, even just that little bit of attention, it's just. Okay, that gives me hope. I was worried. What's the worst movie you've ever seen?
I'm probably Legally Blonde 2. it's the only movie that I've ever rented that I stopped within the first hour, took it out, and went back and returned it.
Wow.
Immediately.
Wow.
I wasn't that old either. I want to say I was maybe 17-ish.
Yeah.
And I actively made a point of doing this.
What offended you so deep? Like, I've seen it, believe it or not, in a theater. Trust me, I didn't make that call. But what bothered you so much about that?
Honestly, I don't remember. I think I just tried to forget. But it was likely just that... From the little bit that I do remember, her representation had gone from flighty yet inspirational to just
flighty.
The human... Well, not even flighty. She became the human... She became the personification of the glass ceiling we're all struggling to break.
Okay.
And she seemed to solidify it. In fact, she seemed to lower it.
Ah, shit.
So all of it just... From the vague bits that I can remember, I think I was just offended by its portrayal of women. And also by the fact that Reese Witherspoon would agree to sign on to something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she was even a producer by that point. Like, that was when she was starting to get clout. Right? I've tried to put that movie out of my memory. The only thing I can really remember from it is they want to get married at Fenway Park.
I don't even know when or how that happens.
I can't remember that it actually does, but at one point or another, I remember a model of Fenway Park, with like a little bride and groom at the pitcher's mound.
Oh God.
So, yeah, I know. Well, and then that just, like, totally gets put aside.
You know, now that you're saying this, for some reason, I think I turned it off and within the first 20 minutes.
That's possible.
I'm pretty sure I did,
okay.
Actually.
Okay, yeah. No, there's what is a classic or essential film that you haven't seen?
Lawrence of Arabia.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. That's one that usually shocks a lot of people.
It doesn't shock me, because that answer has come up many times. I think that was Bob's answer the first time I had him on the show. I guess the only reason I'm kind of surprised is usually when people get into film and they start digging through the usual lists that they dig through, that's usually high up. That's, you know, that's usually like top 10 on most lists that you would find.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you haven't had the time, you're not actively avoiding it.
No, well, probably a little subconsciously,
really?
But well, not actively.
You don't have, do you have like an aversion for length?
No, not okay. at all. Absolutely not.
You have an aversion for Peter O'Toole? For David Lean?
No.
Deserts.
No.
You don't like it where it's dry.
I don't like sand.
Okay.
blue skies and
yes.
sandy seas. No. It's Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay.
And I think
I can hear the capital
reason,
letters the way you say it.
Yes. And it's not taken... because it is what it is... It feels like it is not something to be taken lightly.
Okay.
And there's kind of this mythos that's been built up around it.
Yeah.
Even not even a tangible one, just kind of this like little hovering bubble of prestige that
right.
kind of floats around it. And so I kind of feel like I have to either get to a point where I can kind of let go of that a little bit and just kind of sink into it,
mm-hmm.
or I have to really psych myself up for it and
okay.
just sit down and absorb it.
You're not, as I said, you're not the first person to claim that one as your unseen classic, and I always come back with the same answer, which, and maybe this will give you the impetus to see it when this comes up, is wait until you can see it on a big screen. Preferably, Lightbox every once in a while brings through a 70mm print.
When was the last time they did?
2 years ago.
And have they since?
Yeah. It's when they bring in the 70mm prints, they tend to bring them in around Christmas time.
Okay.
There's only 50 or 60 70mm movies to pick from. So you tend to kind of see the same ones get rolled in and out, and that's usually one of them. But even that notwithstanding, try to see it on a big screen, because that movie, more than anything else, is about scale.
That's,
and
yeah.
and if you watch it, even if you watch it at home, I don't care like how awesome a setup you have at home, it's not going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
So the first time I watched it on like a 20-inch TV.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's the thing, is that if you're, you know, don't worry about like getting to it or pushing it up the list or anything like that. If you're, you know, you look at the listings and somebody's showing it on a screen, then maybe say, okay, let's go. Right? Because then you'll be in it.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be in it as much as you should be in a proper environment. And you might get, like, at that point, you're going to get the most from it that you're ever going to get. And there is an intermission, so if it ain't doing it for you, just bail out. Finally, what is a film that, for any reason, you wish you had a hand in making?
Pulp Fiction.
Cool answer. Why? Well okay, besides the fact that it's Pulp Fiction.
It's fucking Pulp Fiction.
You want to write it, you want to direct it, all of it. You want to act in it, you want to shoot it.
I want to be Mia Wallace. I want to talk to Sam Jackson about a Royale with cheese. I want to do the twist. I want to pump adrenaline into a chick's heart. I want to, you know, try shooting up. I want to flee the scene
without the consequences.
Without
yeah.
the drugs.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is something about that film that's so infectious, and it's, I mean, it's one of those movies that if you go to film school,
yeah.
you study it as a filmmaker.
Oh,
I
yeah.
did not go to film school, so I did not study it as a
you
filmmaker.
You neither, huh?
No.
Up top.
Hey. There is something about it. It's easily in my top 10 films of all time. It just, it courses through my veins, man.
It's
I
so
can't even
cool.
explain.
It is still 20 years later.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Cannes is on right now, and it
yeah.
premiered at Cannes 94. It's still so damn cool.
There are certain films that just kind of permeate your essence.
Mm.
These movies that you can't quite put into words why it is that they infect you the way that they do. That's one of them for me. That's a big one for me. And for some reason, if the first time, like as soon as you're asking, like, what movie would you like to have a hand in making?
Yeah.
If it's kind of a call and response, don't think, just answer. That's the
Pulp
first
Fiction.
Thing that comes to mind.
Cool.
Just because
nice.
Of that.
I certainly can't argue with that. I don't know if that answer's come up before. It may very well have, but that is a great answer. Well, there we go. That's more about Ariel. It's time to learn more about you fine folks. It's your chance to come talk to me right after this. Why are you shaking like a leaf? Come on, come talk to me. I do apologize because after 100 and some odd episodes, I am unknowingly repeating my questions, and this was one of them. I realized after I'd asked the question that I had asked this question before. But I put it to people. I said, in honor of the birthday show, one of the things I'd like to do sometime before I die is host a double feature on my birthday in like a theater that I love. So in Toronto, it could be a theater like the Royal, or it could be, Lord knows, it could be the Lightbox. But I would just love to host a double feature of two movies I love and have like anybody who wants to come by, or certainly people I know, come by. And I said to people, if you could host a double feature on your birthday, what would be the two movies you chose? And I got some responses. Sean Kelly here in Toronto, who writes SK on Movies, just went straight up and said, I would want to show my two all-time favorite films, Donnie Darko and Memento. So, you know, that's certainly a way to go.
That's a pretty serious double feature.
Wait for it. We're going to top that in a bit.
Oh, boy.
Nick from Cinema Romantico in Chicago said The Big Sleep and To Have and Have Not. Three-plus hours of Bogey and Bacall making eyes at one another and trading bon mot is all I really need in my movie-going life. I would totally go to that double feature.
I would, too.
Yeah. Christian from To the Movies and Back said, in the mood for love and Lost in Translation.
Interesting.
Among my favorite films of all time, I feel like they share many themes but are not that similar. You see the influence on Sofia Coppola. I'm crazy about these films. He also said that he could replace In the Mood for Love with Chungking Express.
Wow.
So there's that. Bubba Wheat, who hosts Flight Tights and Movie Nights, said my double feature would be the original Fantasia paired with the lesser-known Robot Carnival. You ever heard of that?
No.
Okay. I think now I'm curious.
Robot Carnival.
Robot Carnival.
I've got to look this up now.
Yeah. I think both would benefit a lot from being seen on a big screen. That, and I would also love to share Robot Carnival with a larger audience. It's an anime that was aired on the Cartoon Network back in the early days, and it's basically an anime version of Fantasia. Oh, okay. With different shorts and different anime directors, most of them have no dialogue, and they're all about robots in one way or another, and has a sequence inspired by Night on Bald Mountain. Like, that might be the greatest birthday gift right there. I think I got to find this movie.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
That actually sounds really interesting.
From Facebook, Nick Hath Zara, who was on my last episode, she's in Dubai, said, I wanted to come up with something creative, but screw it. My two favorite movies of all time, Moulin Rouge, especially for my Bollywood-loving family members who will appreciate the songs and the central love story, and Fight Club, just to see everybody go, what?
Best combination ever.
Yep.
High fives.
My
all
birthday
around.
Cake will be in the shape of soap, and then we'll all have absinthe and dance the can-can.
Yes.
Sir. Awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that you're doing it right, is all I can say.
That's awesome.
Our friend Corey Pierce here in Toronto said, I'd reopen the Toronto Underground for a double bill of The Life of Brian and The Muppet Movie. Both were released around my birthday in 1979. The night would consist of the Underground's bad retro trailers, which would be selected among Caligula, 1941, and Beneath the Valley of Ultra Vixens.
Oh, wow.
Dan Heaton in St. Louis said, he writes Public Transportation Snob, said, I'd go with two films that make me happy, but I haven't been seen by enough people. So the first is Noah Baumbach's Kicking and Screaming, which I still haven't seen.
Neither have I.
I gotta bump that up the list. Which has such a biting wit to it, yet isn't mean, like some of his films. And the second one is the most recent Whit Stillman film, Damsels in Distress.
I am dying to see that.
It's cute. It's like it's kind of fluffy. It's not as
well. I'd expect it would be a little fluffy, but with a tinge of maybe a little bit of darkness, maybe.
Not as much darkness as most of his other movies. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. But it's really sweet. It's definitely a good watch. Mm-hmm. You know, you got Greta Gerwig, and she gets to do some dancing. So you know, what
and
more could
Greta.
You want? Yeah, exactly. He said it isn't my favorite film from him, but I'd like a lot more people to see it. So. You know, well done, Dan. My mom commented. Mom wants to have a double feature of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and Field of Dreams.
Oh, that is quite the double hitter.
Yeah, you know, like people want to know my movie going DNA.
There it is.
There it is. You know,
nice and wholesome.
And I would totally go. Red George wants to show A Town Called Panic and Mary and Max. For some reason, this is always an amazing double feature. Two completely different types of comedy. Have you seen either of those?
No.
They are glorious animation.
I was going to say, Mary and Max was, what, Australian?
Australian. Town Called Panic is French. Town Called Panic is similar. Imagine Robot Chicken, but without the actual pop culture toys.
Okay.
Like, they use, like, a little toy Indian and a little toy cowboy, and I think there's a horse, and they all talk, and they're
it's goofy.
Yeah, it's really goofy and really crazy and very French. And I think they're both on Netflix, actually. I know Mary Max is, because that's how
yeah.
I saw it. Yeah, that would... Yeah, he would have the crowd in the palm of his hand, for sure.
Oh, good.
I gotta assume the next one, again, is just two favorites, because I can't think of the connection for the life of me. But Mike Mendez in Los Angeles wants to show Young Frankenstein and Goodfellas.
That's awesome.
Exactly.
That's just
yeah.
as good as
yeah.
Fight Club and Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
I'm
amazing.
All over that. I don't know the connection. Don't care. I'm there. Yeah, that's great. Matt Kowalski in Germany wants to show 2001 A Space Odyssey and The Little Mermaid. Because A, those two movies are who I am. Okay. And B, if this happened, we would be one step closer to discovering the secret planet of the Merpeople.
So what, the teleportation from
I guess.
2001 would bring you close? Really, honestly, if anything's going to teleport you into Disney's universe, you probably don't want to be there.
No. Yeah, I now, just because
know.
She brings it up and it will come up again, did you get Ariel jokes as a kid?
Yeah.
Oh. That probably, did that, like, piss you off, like, no tomorrow?
Yeah.
Still does?
Especially since I came first.
That's, yeah,
well,
that's...
Like, anytime I get introduced to anybody.
Really?
Generally, the first... It's gotten a little bit better
okay.
now,
but
almost, I'd say, about 75% of the time I get introduced to anyone, they will say, oh, like The Little Mermaid. And I say, yes, uh-huh.
See,
true.
It didn't dawn on me until like this, and I've known you
really?
For... I didn't... That wasn't where my brain went when
so
you...
Refreshing.
See? Look at me. Look at me. Well, you know?
And technically, I'm Shakespearean. My mom named me after the character from The Tempest.
Oh.
So...
There we go.
The Little Mermaid can just...
Suck it. Right. Yeah. Done. We got some answers from Twitter, and buckle up, Buttercup.
Okay.
Matt Price said, "Sit in Tango and Showa." It gives me and when I asked him why, he said it gives me great intense pleasure to watch others suffer both on screen and in the audience. Happy birthday to Matt.
That's a mad answer.
Yeah, my brother Shane tweeted from his honeymoon, which makes me think you're doing it wrong, but
he's just really supportive of you.
No. he wants to see the double bill of The Little Mermaid and The Piano, which he then hashtagged Under the Sea. That's cold. Funny, but cold.
That's hilarious.
my friend Andrew Robinson in Jamaica said the idea of a birthday double bill means it has to be happy and about him. So he wants to show E.T. and Francis Ha because they are two films about finding home, whether it be for the first time or the billionth time, and also letting go of what worked in the past.
That's I don't necessarily agree with those two together, but I think that is a beautiful, beautiful sentiment,
mm-hmm.
and I absolutely agree with it.
Yeah,
especially
yeah.
about something like yeah. Francis Ha. So I love
you
just,
love Francis Ha.
That's so nice.
You know what? I got to thank people because I'm getting towards the end, but I always, on my birthday show, I always get the most responses. It always takes like the most amount of time to get through the feedback. So thank you, folks, for. You know, for all the tweets and comments and whatnot on this. Sometimes it's pulling teeth to get comments back. Rich Watson in New York said he would show Time Bandits and the Muppet Movie. That sounds like fun. Alex Withrow, who was my guest two episodes ago, said he'd go with Persona and Cries and Whispers.
Oh, that's heavy.
Yeah. He said, I've never seen Bergman on the big screen and that'd be heaven.
Elizabeth,
yeah. James Blake Ewing down in Texas. He's a fan. No, I should have guessed this one. He wants to see Days of Heaven and Playtime. One because it's his favorite. The other because he wants to see it on a big screen.
Which is Playtime?
That is the Jacques Tati movie, which is also a 70mm film, and it's just abstract. It's basically his Hulot character going through. Modern Parisian life. There's like a long sequence in a convention floor, a long sequence in a restaurant, and then a long sequence leaving Paris. And it's just random interactions with 1960s modern living in Paris. My friend Kate Bradford from Kate Has a Blog said baby boom and working girl because there's nothing like sexual politics and 80s hair. Danielle Darnellis said My Man Godfrey and Bringing Up Baby. Screwball comedies make for great party films. I have 363 days to make this happen. Mm-hmm. Jandy Stone Hardesty in Los Angeles said In a Lonely Place and The Young Girls of Rochefort? One of those? Rochefort. Achingly bittersweet / cynical and candy-colored optimistic back-to-back. Jandy, I haven't seen either one of those, so my birthday gift from you is two movies that you recommended. And I had two people give me the same double feature. I could not believe this shit. So Anna in upstate New York and Daniel McCarthy in England both suggested, completely unbeknownst to one another, both suggested Ace in the Hole and The Sweet Smell of Success.
Huh.
I'm like, guys, like kismet right there. If there wasn't an ocean dividing them, I'd say, you know, that's a love match right there. I love Ace in the Hole. I've actually never seen Sweet Smell of Success.
Neither have I.
Those are a lot of great double features, folks. So thank you for all of those. Did you manage to come up with one?
I did.
Oh, what do you got?
And this was another kind of Pulp Fiction reaction.
Okay.
React instantaneously.
Gotcha. All right.
Back to the Future.
Okay.
And Raiders.
If you're looking for a fun double feature, like fun 80s adventure, you know,
mm-hmm.
We're going to be talking about both of those directors later on. Have you seen either or both of those on a big screen?
No, actually.
Really? Okay.
I haven't. And those are two of the Back to the Future trilogy and the Indiana Jones trilogy. It is not a quartet. There is only three.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
That's going to be a drinking game for this episode.
How many times do we say that? Those two trilogies are two of the most influential films of my childhood. I know Back to the Future practically like the back of my hand, and again, those are two movies that have just always kind of, they've always existed in my life. The notion of finding people who have never seen them shocks me.
Okay.
And just the idea of having both of those back to back is just the happiest parts of my childhood.
And yeah, like you're settling in and just letting them play back to back. Oh, no, I would totally go to that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't actually come up with an answer to my own question. I know one. It's not the most festive double feature, but it is one that I'm actually looking forward to watching back to back. And I probably soon, too, because I'm going to get my hands on one of these movies very soon. Is I want to watch the double feature of Her and Lost in Translation. Because I want to watch the double feature of the disillusionment of Spike Jonze and Sofia Coppola's relationship from both sides. Because that's the thing. That's Sofia's... Lost in Translation is Sofia's version of how things went apart and she started to feel isolated and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And Her is Spike dealing with the aftermath. And they're both so beautiful.
Yeah.
They're both so quiet and so... in both cases, I just want to go into those places and those worlds,
mm-hmm.
even though, you know, one obviously is our world, one is very much not.
Yeah.
And I just think that would be cool to watch back to back on a big screen. As I said, everybody would probably leave bummed out.
Not necessarily. I don't think either end negatively.
No, they don't end negatively, but they're both just very down.
Again, I don't fully agree.
Okay.
I think, and maybe this is just a perspective thing, and everybody comes out of it differently, and that would be a beautiful thing to find out
That's the litmus test from all my guests.
Exactly.
You know, to see how people deal.
Yeah.
And it's strange because I know, like, at least with Lost in Translation, there's a lot of people who don't like that movie.
No, I know.
Which to me is crazy.
Well, it's not for everybody.
Yeah, that's true. So that would be my double feature. As I said. You know, it might not be for everybody, but hey, it's my birthday.
There you go. It's your party, and you'll cry if you want to.
That's right. Next episode, I'm kind of curious. I took pen to paper to try and map out the summer's worth of matinee casts, and I got to be honest, folks, there are not a lot of big movies coming down the pike that I'm really looking forward to talking about. I'm going to see them. I'm sure I'm going to write about them. I just don't really see the need to dedicate 25 minutes to talking about any of them. So I want to know, what are the indie movies that people are looking forward to seeing? There's a lot of stuff coming, a lot of stuff that's going to start making the rounds, stuff that's going to, like, you know, flutter between on demand and whatnot. And, you know, if I get a common answer over and over, I might try to bump that up the queue and build a show around it. So let me know, what are some of the indie movies coming this summer that you're really looking forward to seeing? Ryan@thematinee.ca. Twitter, where I'm matinee_CA, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. As mentioned, we are not going to be talking about a new release, so if for some reason you have never seen our feature review, be warned, because we're going to spoil the holy hell out of every element of Indiana
and its
Jones.
Counterparts.
Yes, but come right back after this for the new slang. The new slang is Raiders of the Lost Ark. Raiders of the Lost Ark is directed by Steven Spielberg. It is written by Lawrence Kasdan, based on a story by George Lucas. It stars Harrison Ford, Karen Allen, Paul Freeman, and John Rhys-Davies. If you've been living under a stone, it is the story of Indiana Jones and his quest to retrieve the Ark of the Covenant before Nazis get their hands on it. And for that, he's going to need help from his one-time paramour, Marion Ravenwood, and his man Friday, Sala. So, I've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark so many times over the course of my life that I've lost count. It is hard to know where to begin discussing it, but something occurred to me this morning while I was thinking about its place in film lore and its sense of legacy. It is the quintessential adventure film, certainly of our lifetime. You have search for treasure, you have a swashbuckling hero, you have a damsel in distress, you have some dastardly villains, and feats of daring do. It brings all these pieces together so well that it seems to have covered its tracks in a way that no film can follow. So, pop quiz, hotshot. Why, in almost 35 years, have we never seen another adventure movie as good as this?
Because you can't recreate lightning in a bottle.
This is true. But there have been other great sci-fi films since Star Wars. There have been other great dramas since Fill in the Drama. There have been other great horrors since Psycho. Why did we get to 1981? And like the only movie I can think of that comes close, and even still, it's not quite on a par, it's not even close to being on a par, is the first Pirates of the Caribbean film. Nowhere else do we have, like, literally adventure. We've got action. Every other genre is still going on.
There are, in spite of the fact that you can have, you know, that there have been great sci-fi films since Star Wars and even well beyond, and that, yes, there have been great horror films since and after Psycho and so on and so forth. There have been good adventure films and there have been good action films and things of the like, but it... Even within those genres, even if you've had great ones or remotely good ones that have come after, you're not going to recreate... You can't recreate lightning in a bottle. I think that's just... It was such a unique combination of so many wonderful elements and, you know, George Lucas not putting his foot down about too many things, thank
right.
God.
Yeah.
As far as I'm aware. But... It was the right place at the right time, and we won't see that again. That will never happen again. The same way that Back to the Future will never happen again. The same way, you know, Kramer versus Kramer will never happen again. The same way Martyrs will never happen again.
Yeah.
Like, you get these films that are just, they do what they're supposed to do, and I know I might get some flack for mentioning Kramer versus Kramer.
It's
I
can fine.
Think of a specific person who
I
might...
I could think of it, too.
...qualm that. but I just... I mean, there is a place and a time for certain films to come about, and sometimes they're just... Maybe they're too big to be created in any other time. Maybe the time just... It's, you know, the stars aligned. Who knows? But I don't think it... I just... You can't recreate lightning in a bottle.
No. I have two... when I thought about the answer to my own question, I thought of two theories. The first is the fact that it's a throwback. And there's only so many times that you can play the nostalgia card. Like it's literally it's a Saturday afternoon matinee. It's a serial film from the 1940s.
It's pulp.
Right. It's very much pulp. And other films have tried. Other films, especially after it worked, other films, and to this day, other films try to capture that Saturday afternoon matinee from the 1940s aesthetic. And like Lord knows, Stephen Sommers made 3 Mummy movies trying to do it.
And the first one definitely got there-ish.
Right, but not to this extent. So it's you know, you can only work nostalgia so well so often. And it's not just contained to Raiders. Every successful film will spawn a bunch of copiers, and some of them work, some of them don't. Go back to the early part of the century and look at all of the sword and sandal movies that like follow Gladiator.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there you go. Like for every Gladiator, you get an Alexander.
Yes.
So that was my thought of number one, is when you play nostalgia, you can only do that so often. The other thing I thought about is I wonder if we're now in the era that's come since, in the 90s and now in the new century with the millennials, I wonder if we're just past the point where kids played these kinds of adventure. Like, I'm not going to be the old grumpy guy who says that kids don't ride their bikes and climb trees
but
anymore.
But they don't.
So I kind of want, because that was the thing, is that this was playing on our childhood. And on our parents' childhood, certainly, because they would have been of the right age, too. And I want, like, you know, I don't see kids pretending to be Indiana Jones.
Nobody wants anything that engages their minds, really, so much anymore. We want something that's relatively easily digestible, and that's generally pretty easy to process.
Yeah.
And that's not everybody...
Yeah, like no, I know lots of children that are the exception to that rule, but in general, that's, you know, it's troubling. Do you remember the first time you saw this movie?
Oh, God. No. I don't think so.
It's like, that's the thing, like, I barely know a world without this movie.
Yeah.
You certainly don't, because you're younger than I am. The thing that I kind of wish, now in both of our cases, is that I would have had the chance to see it for the first time on a big screen. I've seen it on a big screen a few times, actually. But the first time, like you, the first time I watched this would have been at home on video. And strangely, actually, the crazy thing is I saw Temple of Doom, which we'll talk about later, not long after it came out. I saw that one first. At age 9.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see this one until I was about 12.
Really?
Yeah. I saw them out of order.
Oh, that's peculiar.
Right? Right?
My parents wouldn't have allowed that.
I don't know how mine... Like, I really don't... Considering all the movies that my parents showed me... Like, you know, my parents showed me Platoon. Right? I don't know how
at
they...
At what, 9?
Yeah, exactly. Or The Untouchables, you know? Like, and Alien... I don't know how this one wasn't amongst the first ones that I saw. Like, I specifically had to pick it out at the video store and bring it on home. Mm-hmm. When I was going to the video store and picking stuff out by myself, which, again, wasn't until I was, like, 11 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
But, I loved it on first watch, as I'm sure everybody does. I'd kind of be curious to talk to somebody who didn't love it. Do you have any early memories of seeing it? Or, like, did you... I'm sure you, like, wander around the house kind of humming the song or stuff like that.
Well, not only would I wander around the house humming the song, but when I was in grade 4 and they started putting instruments in our hands, I had to learn how to play it on flute, so I know that.
Cool.
That is a skill that I have that I will probably never use again, but I can play the flute. Like so many other films, it's just always been there. It's kind of this unquestionable entity in my life that is, you know, it will always exist in the ether of who I am.
Yeah.
Like, I have no memories of the first time I watched it. I just always, to me, that movie, like Back to the Future, is a family thing. I think if I had to make some kind of association with it, it would be City TV. Because we always used to, when, you know, we would buy VHS now and then, but we didn't have a very big collection, and my parents would tape things off of City TV.
Yeah, mine too.
So we had, like, for the longest time, the only versions I knew of Raiders, Temple of Doom, Last Crusade, Back to the Futures 1 through 3
yeah.
were the versions that we got off of late night city TV movies.
Yeah.
And so all of them had stuff cut out, or they had, like, the language was dubbed in and this, that, and the other. And I do distinctly remember, like, maybe less so about this and more so with Back to the Future, but the first time I had watched it when I finally got the DVD, it's like, oh, he swore. He's shit. That's not in it. And it was like this weird thing. And that happened. I can't think of any specific instances with indie, but that did happen a lot.
Yeah. No, I'm the same. I remember the first time I saw it widescreen, I was like, holy crap, there's extra stuff. Look at that.
Look at the size.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it's, you know, and yeah, my first, it might have been that my first experience with it was TV, but I think I seem to remember specifically in going and renting that movie. When I did rewatch it, that was my holiday Monday. I focused in on the two main characters. So we got Harrison Ford playing Indiana Jones. And the thing I like about him in this, he's almost playing the same character in Indiana Jones as he does with Han Solo. And that's that he's a really good scoundrel.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And
but he's a little bit classier.
He as Indiana Jones?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe not classy. Maybe classy is the wrong term.
He cleans up nice. You know, we see him at the end of this in his suit.
Oh, yeah. Maybe he's a little bit less of a scoundrel as Indy. There's a bit more niceness to him.
Because he's an academic.
Yes.
Okay, that's the reason why. Because sure. Lord knows I don't see Han Solo wearing a tweed jacket.
Oh, God, no.
But it's kind of crazy, because one of the reasons why I think he does so well in the role and why, like, it's such an iconic character is he's such a good scoundrel, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's the famous story about how when the part was conceived, it was conceived for Tom Selleck. And I think if it had been given to Tom Selleck, mm-hmm. I don't know that it would have worked as well.
It wouldn't have.
You know, you need somebody in this part who... You know, he's kind of a badass, but he's a badass that you want to root for.
Well, you would usually want to root for the badass, but he's the John McClane of fantasy. He's fallible. There is something about him that is tangible, that is attainable, that is relatable. He's bendable. He's breakable. You see the reaction his body has to everything that he's doing. And he, you know, bungles things up, and he screws stuff up now and then, and sometimes benefits from the mistake and sometimes doesn't. He also has an incredible sex appeal. And
I do.
I know many people who would. I sincerely, yeah. I mean, when you factor all of that in and the fact that he's just, that Harrison Ford is just built for that kind of character.
Yeah.
He's such an old school, especially because it's kind of pulpy.
Yeah.
He's got such a kind of old school Humphrey Bogart thing to him.
Yeah, like, you know, when Nick mentioned earlier the Bogie and Bacall movies,
yeah.
Like, you know, you could drop Bogie and Bacall into these parts.
Oh, absolutely.
And they'd work.
Yes.
You know,
Bogart would be Indy, and Bacall would be Rittenwood.
Yeah. And speaking of, now, we've had this conversation before, and again, we'll get back there in a bit, but... I think Karen Allen might actually be underrated. I kind of do feel sad that she kind of became a victim of time in Hollywood, because there's really not a whole lot of her after Scrooged in 91 or 1990, whatever year that movie came out. But she is fan friggin' tastic as the damsel in distress in this movie. Possibly because half the time she's in distress, but she, you know, you realize it's just she's just been overwhelmed. Like, she never gets in distress because she hasn't tried to get out of it.
She's never in distress.
She's in a basket in a truck that's gonna blow up.
Yeah, but she's strapped in the basket. It's not like she's been.
She's still calling out for help. She's not tied to the train tracks.
No, you think of a damsel in distress, you think of someone who's thrown you over their shoulder and
right.
is carrying you away, and you're swooning and going, oh, I can't help myself. She would kick you square in the nuts and run off. She will bash you in the head with a frying pan.
And then she'll drink you under the table.
Exactly. Yeah,
and that is what, like, one, you believe her.
Yes, you know, absolutely
like, you totally believe that she could do all of that. And I, like I said, I think that's what makes that character work and what ultimately helps make the movie work.
Oh, absolutely. And she, and because you don't buy, and I know you're going to jump on this one, you don't buy Indiana Jones with a flaky broad, which, yes, I know what you're thinking of, I know, which we'll get into, and even in Temple, she's a bit of a flake.
A bit?
A bit.
Okay.
And she's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
But, goddammit, that woman's got gumption.
Okay.
And she may be a little shallow, and she may be kind of vapid, but at the same time, she knows how to get what she wants, she knows how to do what she wants, and in the end, at the end of the day, she can take care of herself.
You know what I'm going to say, right?
Bullshit?
No. We'll get there.
Yeah. We'll get there.
So, the other thing, when I rewatched this movie this week, the thing I loved is, we're in an age where more is more.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there, you know, you have directors who are directing action movies who just never know when to say when on a set piece. You have, like, fight sequences that level entire cities and just go on and on and on. And the thing that I love, not just about, the, like, really about all of the Indiana Jones films, but especially about this one, because it's really in play, is all of the set pieces are like a game of Mousetrap.
Yeah.
You know, every single one of the set pieces, so, you know, a fight ensues. And in the course of the fight, a lock jams. And also in the course of the fight, the chalk blocks get knocked out from underneath the plane.
And then something topples over.
And then the plane starts moving, and it sets off these gas tanks. Mm-hmm. And on and on. So you watch these things, these carefully constructed games of Mousetrap, just waiting for that final, you know, thing to go that's just going
to
set
the
whole...
For the propeller?
Right, exactly. Or, you know, or for the boulder to roll or something like that.
Yeah.
I talked about, like, how this movie endures, and that's one of those things, is it's like clockwork. All of these sequences, every single set piece in this movie knows when to say when and get out and move on to the next thing.
Yeah. It's the timing and the pacing of everything, and just, I mean, the, like, when you really think about it, that boulder scene, that opening sequence, is single-handedly one of the most iconic moments ever committed to celluloid.
Absolutely.
In history.
Yep.
It's how do you come up with that? How do you birth that from your brain? And actually create it to the point where it's so perfect.
Yeah.
So timely that it just it will live indelibly in the minds of everyone from here until eternity.
Yeah. Where you set a series of booby traps that, you know, you watch the hero navigate his way through and almost makes you forget, oh crap, he's got to run back through them.
Yeah.
You know, he takes that first step and those arrows start flying and just, it clicks, oh crap, he's going to have to jump over the pit and that thing's going to come down. And that's even before you know that there's a boulder waiting for him.
Yeah.
You know? And it's also good that you don't even question that the Jovitos created a perfectly spherical boulder.
Yeah.
And shoved it into this temple.
Yep.
Right? You never question the logic of that.
Never.
Which on paper is absurd.
Absolutely.
But is
absurd.
Glorious.
But again, that's that pulp.
Yes.
And it's just, it's so,
Yeah.
I can't.
You and I have talked about this before.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we are waxing on about this movie, because Lord knows we're not going to say a single negative thing about it.
No.
Except.
What?
That the movie succeeds despite the gigantic flaw, which has been pointed out by people far smarter than me for many, many years, so I'm not doing anything here. In that, don't cross your arms. No,
I'm
this
just
isn't.
Listening.
Okay, I've had this conversation with you before. I'm actually kind of happy that you've forgotten. That in the reality of this movie, our hero doesn't actually do anything heroic.
Oh.
All he manages to do through this movie is create a whole bunch of property damage and slow the Nazis down, right down to the very end. He does not even get the loot at the end of the movie. He does not recover the Ark properly. It's taken away from him and put in the warehouse, and away we go.
Because so, he can't. If he were to, if it would be far more absurd if he were to take the Ark afterwards and put it in some museum. It would make so much less sense.
But no, but my point is, like, for every point he puts on the board, the Nazis put two. At every single turn, he is always playing one goal behind. Well, the best he can ever do is tie the score momentarily.
Well, yeah, but how?
And then
realistic...
they take back the girl, or they get the Ark back, or they take him prisoner again.
But how realistic would it be for one man to be able to actually, believably, single-handedly take down part of the Nazis?
They do it the rest of the way. The other films, he's far more ahead of the game than he is. He's not like, you know, one of them, he even gets the loot.
Well, yeah.
But here's the thing. The cool thing about it is we don't care.
No.
You know, that's the thing. It's the flaw in the story is that our hero isn't that heroic, but we don't give a shit.
But it's also part of what makes him, like I was saying before, it's part of what makes him fallible. It's part of what makes him relatable. He would be a superhero otherwise, and he's not. He's done. He's not, though. And he never pretends to be. Not in any one of the films. Including the bastardization that was birthed a couple of years ago.
Well, by that point, he's old.
Then not the point. He's never a superhero.
Okay.
Ever.
Okay.
And I think that's a part of why that we kind of buy into that notion that he doesn't really do anything heroic, which...
Right.
Fine, I'll agree to, because really, when you break it down... He has moments of natural heroism, but he does not... He's not this... He's fallible.
And that's the thing. Like, but that's that. In the end, that might be what makes it work. That's probably what makes it work. Because if he was, you know, if he was, we're getting ahead of ourselves. But if he was the kind of character that Kathleen Turner writes about in Romancing the Stone, we wouldn't buy it.
No.
You know.
No.
That's a different kind of scoundrel that we just wouldn't buy.
It is.
So. Did you have any other, like, you know, we could be talking forever about Raiders of the Lost Ark, but was there, like, when you were thinking about this movie this week, was there anything else that, like, popped to mind that...
Not really. Like, it's just this... It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
I can't do, like, I can discuss it if there are specific points that come up to discuss it, but
that's the hard
just...
thing about it. And honestly, when I decided that was the favorite that I was going to tackle for this year's birthday show, that was the hard thing. I was like, what the shit do you talk about? Mm-hmm. Raiders of the Lost Ark, almost 35 years later, that hasn't been talked about to death. And, but, you know, and you know, how do you just not say this movie is awesome?
Well, because that's all you really
minutes.
Need to say.
Yeah. The crazy thing is I'd actually... One of the things I'd kind of like to look for is I'd love to find somebody who's never seen it. And see... Oh, I'm sure they do. You know, like, yeah, you haven't seen Lawrence of Arabia, right? There's somebody out there who hasn't seen Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And yet there is... It's odd, actually, that you bring that up. Well, funny, kind of, because it's... I think generally people would be more offended to find someone who hadn't seen Raiders than they are to see somebody who hasn't seen Lawrence of Arabia.
I think it's because it's so child-friendly... It's one of those movies that you kind of start with, right? Like, it's one of those ones that you show children probably right after you got finished showing them The Wizard of Oz.
Probably.
And actually, it's, you know, I do remember when I saw it when I was young. We talked last night about how I was a real pussy when I was young and I couldn't handle scary stuff. And I do remember when I was young, like, the first time I saw that Ark get opened and those faces melt, oh, I freaked the hell out.
Oh, yeah.
Oh man, I couldn't even watch that scene for the first few years.
I don't think I was allowed to watch
it
for
12,
the first few years.
At 12.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what I say. When I say I was a pussy, I beat it.
Yeah.
I got over it by like 14 or 15, but for a while there I was like, ah.
That's cute.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, we're not going to rate this movie because, first of all, we know what the rating would be, and second of all, because I think it's just ridiculous to rate a classic film. But we will do the souvenir. So if you could take a wander through the Raiders of the Lost Ark gift shop and keep anything, be it a tangible piece or a line or a shot or a piece of dialogue, what would be your souvenir from Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Karen Allen's dress when they finally get on the boat. Before she
that King Kong-esque dress.
Yep.
That is one I noticed that on Blu-ray when I watched it the other day. That is a dress and a half.
It is a dress and a half. I remember that is one thing that I can honestly say from the first time I ever saw Raiders of the Lost Ark till now, that as a little girl I was in awe of that dress, and I just thought it was the most beautiful thing. And because she was such a force to be reckoned with, I was like, that's a dress that a tough woman wears. I need to wear that dress. So I've always kind of had that in my mind as I need that. So if I could take...
I think you've just like laid out a birthday gift for like anybody who wants to get you one.
Oh, basically.
I don't know why. Two things, actually. I don't know why it never clued in before. I probably noticed it, but I didn't notice it. One, I never really noticed that she changes dresses.
Yeah.
For some strange reason, I thought she was wearing the same one that...
That got torn up and had
yeah,
the poofy sleeves.
I thought she was wearing the same one that Belloc gave her.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. As I said, the other day I was like, oh, right. Because she mentions that the captain has it in his quarters.
Well, yeah, they say that, yeah.
Yeah, I figure I'm not the first woman to come in here.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I really clicked in, and again, I don't know why I never thought about this before, was, again, how much of a pull that is from the dress Faye Ray wears in King Kong. Because they're cut the same. It's the same era.
It's exact. Well, no.
But that's supposed to be 39, and King Kong would have been 33. So we're not far. We're close.
Not far. Yeah, it's pretty close. It's iconic. That's why they definitely pulled from it because of that. Heroine.
Yeah. No, that's a great souvenir.
Yeah.
Mine is not a tangible item. Mine is the love of happy accidents, and it's the shooting of the swordsman.
Oh,
because
yeah.
The story goes that in the script, they had this long, elaborate duel set out for Indiana Jones and this swordsman in the market, and this like duel of whip versus sword that was supposed to go on for quite some time, and that Harrison Ford was just terribly sick that day, and they weren't getting the shot, and he went to Spielberg and he goes, you got like 5 minutes left in me, so whatever you're gonna get it now. And Spielberg said out loud, well, why don't you just shoot him? And apparently all the extras just busted out laughing, thinking that was the funniest thing they'd ever seen, or the funniest thing they'd ever heard of. So he's like, all right, let's roll that. And that's the only take they got of it, and that's why. And you can almost see on his face how sick he is. Like, he's sweating like crazy, and his expression is really just like, oh, nuts to this, you know, and that's one of those things in movies that always makes me laugh.
See, the way I had heard the story was that he was so sick and tired of everything that he just did it kind of as a lark, and then they reshot it because he loved it. I didn't know that he had actually prefaced with, you got nothing in me, so decide.
Oh yeah, no, he said to him, like, this is, we're almost done. He's like, you know, yeah. I can't, and he's and like apparently like some sickness just went through like the whole crew, and it got forward that day.
Yeah.
So no, and that's the thing I love is that was not in the script. That was just totally something that just one of those movie moments that just happens, and that it's so perfect. Ah.
And it's a great story.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you haven't had enough Indiana Jones, because we're coming back with a humdinger of a conversation after this. So give us a quick break here, and we'll be right back to flip the record over and play the other side. Not to get too crazy and creative with our other side, Ariel Fisher has chosen to continue the series and marry up Raiders of the Lost Ark with its prequel chronologically, but sequel in the rest of the world, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, released in 1984, directed again by Steven Spielberg, and I think basically she's done it just to piss me off. So
actually, no, but fine.
Okay.
I'll let your ego have that.
So, why do you like this movie so much?
Because it's... Honestly, if I'm going to answer totally honestly,
yes.
Because I am woefully biased, and I love that trilogy as a whole. I can acknowledge that of the three, it is the lesser.
Okay.
I still don't think it is a bad film at all.
Neither do I, to be clear.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes, this just proved that... Yeah.
No. but okay, so you just, like, you see it as, you see them as a complete series, like, you've never gone in with your 20-something brain that's much more educated and cynical and critical and picked the nits apart and started to...
I did for this.
Oh, my goodness.
And not because
it is my birthday.
It is your birthday. Well, happy birthday. Mm. if we're to consider this as the prequel, which technically it is, Indy isn't who he was in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Okay.
He's a totally different person. He hasn't gotten there yet. And so we're seeing that transition.
He seems like he's pretty close to there if he's not there yet. Now, I famously pissed you off and endured the scorn of Fisher. And then it was actually a really great thing because then I went on to the Cinecast and got nothing coming back at me. It was a great warm-up because I like this movie. I don't love this movie. Mm-hmm. I like it less than I did the first time I saw it. And I have now unleashed the very unpopular opinion that the Indiana Jones Chronicles are too amazing movies and two pretty good movies. To put a point on this, I have said that this movie is on a par with Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and that any flaw that anybody can point to in that fourth film, I can point to in this movie. So, the two easiest targets with this movie, the two easiest targets...
Debatable.
Oh no. Are... the girl and the sidekick, because every movie, like these movies, all have the same sort of structure. They all have a foil. They all have one girl. There's usually only one woman in the cast. There's always some sort of sidekick who's hanging around. They all have the loot and so on and so forth. And never in this series is the damsel in distress as shrill, useless, and overall annoying as Willie Scott is in this movie. And seldom, I'm not going to say never, but seldom is the sidekick as... oh man, I don't even know where to begin with this kid. But he's not useless. I'll give him that. He's
not useless at all. In fact, he is incredibly useful.
He is a brutal caricature. He's bordering on our being a racist portrayal.
And Sala isn't?
Sala is, to a degree, but Sala succeeds on the back of John Rhys-Davies. If you give that character to anybody else, you're screwed. But John Rhys-Davies manages to sell it.
So are you trying to say that Short Round is basically Mickey Rooney?
I had that thought.
Even though he actually is.
That's what's saving him. But okie dokie, hold on to your potatoes is not helping him. You know
what? What about that phrase is particularly racially insensitive?
It makes the kid can speak normally. Most of the rest of the way he's making complete sense.
Except that he's an orphan who's probably about 10 years old, who has lived on the street most of his life and was probably only relatively recently taught English by Indy, who took him under his wing.
I know. Well, now we're extrapolating a lot of information that's not actually there. You know, but the rest of the way, he's speaking just fine and he's understanding just fine. But every once in a while, like even just when I rewatched it the other day, and yes, I did. You know, even just the moment where he's in the temple, the banquet hall, and the dancers are coming towards him, right? And he goes, and he runs away like they are the scariest things he's ever seen. I'm like, are you kidding me? You've seen scarier things already. You're just out in the jungle with bats and pythons and all this crap. Why are the women with the scarves scaring you?
Because it is something culturally different that he has never seen. Because women where he's from don't do that.
No, the precocious... broken English sidekick.
He's also a child.
Why do we need a child in this series? It's the only time they brought in a child.
Yes, and the reason why they brought in a child was to counterbalance the greed that Harrison Ford is feeling. It's to force him to grow up. There is an element of that. Think about it. When he gets poisoned, when he drinks the blood from the skull cup,
right?
A scene that terrified me as a kid.
Yeah.
More than the Kalima
Shabide. Oh, we'll get there too. Yeah.
He is saved by unadulterated love. He is saved by being, well, for one, he's burnt by Shortcut.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's what saves him, if we're gonna get into nitpicking.
And what wakes him up is shrieking, "I love you." That is what brings him around. Short Round is his hopefulness. Short Round,
I would
is
argue that it's the fire
exuberance
that wakes him up, and the you know, he says it, and you know, it's just because the kid won't give up on him, which is a lovely thought. And you know, if we hadn't already gone by the time, I will admit this. By the time we get that deep into the story, by the time we get into, you know, the mine car chase and hold on, lady, we're going for a ride and everything like that, I'm generally okay with him by then. But that whole first two acts where, you know, no more parachutes and him screaming every now and then and okie dokie, hold on to your potatoes, and, you know, no time for love, Dr. Jones. I'm like,
that's a great line.
I do use that line, actually,
that is an
but
amazing
I'm like,
line.
Oh, you stupid kid. Give me Sala any day of the week. Get that kid.
But that's the thing.
But he's okay, but to be honest, he is the minor annoyance. The gigantic friggin' annoyance in this movie. The brutal, really annoyance. Is Willie Scott, who is, like I said to you before, and I'll say it again, I have no idea how she didn't get left in that village. I have no earthly clue why he didn't say, we'll send for you. Because she's already proven herself to be pretty darn useless.
He had no intention of staying. He didn't plan to help the kids. He didn't plan to help
anybody. They told him. They said, you're going to Pancott Palace and you're going to look for the stone.
Yeah, and he went.
All right, lady, come along.
No,
you stay there.
He goes to Pancott Palace not to find the stones. He goes to Pancott Palace to get his ass out of Dodge. At the beginning, his intentions are not noble.
I don't know. I think he's looking for him. I think when he goes with the intention of coming back with those stones.
Absolutely not.
Or at least checking out what's going on and getting word back.
At the very least, he has the intention of taking the stones and leaving. It isn't until
there
he
are
sees
so
how the
many times are. before they get to, like, you know, again, the Indy, I love you. There are so many times, and that's actually when things really get bad, is all that shrieking there, where I'm thinking Willie Scott should have just been, baby should have been put in a corner, mom and dad should get going.
And
I don't know how this character keeps her along, other than the fact that he wasn't thinking with his head.
Well, no, he was thinking with his head. Willie Scott tags along, not because, if you'll notice, I mean, she really does take care of herself. She's just tagging along. She doesn't know she does. If anything, Indy needs her. There are countless situations where she saves his ass.
Yeah.
And not as many when the reverse is true.
There's one I can think of, and even then she barely manages to get her hand in that little bug-ridden hole.
Still, she does, and she is needed. She is necessary. That's not to say that is to validate the entire character's presence.
Right.
But you look at the character. She's a showgirl.
Yeah.
The only reason he tags her along... even when they're at the club, he's using her as a bartering tool.
Oh, I get her at the club.
And then the only reason she comes with is because she has the antidote stuffed in her bra.
Right.
And then the only reason she gets on the plane...
How convenient.
...is because she has nowhere else to go, and they're stuck in this situation.
Screw that. Leave her back there. She's Lao Che's girl. Leave her there.
Just told her to get killed, basically. So there's no reason for her to stay.
I think you're thinking he's more virtuous than he is. Because Indy... Like, I don't think that he's so noble at this point that he's bringing the girl along.
Oh, no, he's not bringing the girl along. The girl is bringing herself along. That's what I'm saying. She is tagging along with Indy because he is a big, strong man of means and of reputation who has the ability to get her home safely.
I know. But he's...
She sticks around.
I hate
that
her
is the only
so
reason.
Much.
I can't argue with that because she is a little shrill. And
a
she
little?
Is a little. Even she's... I don't hate her. And I'm, you know, hyper-feminist, rah-rah, don't be a weak little blah.
Right.
But, you know, even she doesn't infuriate me that much. She did the first little bit when I, you know, maybe when I was really little, all I saw was, ooh, pretty glittery dress, and I thought that was really awesome. And then she became useless, and then she very quickly stopped being useless. There is a turning point there. And she's not Marianne Ravenwood.
No, and I think that is the ultimate trump card, is that every other damsel in distress or femme fatale in this series runs circles around her. Like, we get Marion again, and we get, you know, we get the German girl in Last Crusade. Ilsa, and they're all just...
Which is awesome that they called her Ilsa.
Yeah, but they're all just so much better. And so, like, you know, than Willie Scott. It's like, she is the weak link in this series in terms of that role, by a country mile.
Well, yeah, and that's a perfectly fair argument, but generally everybody is different. Every character is different.
They are, but she's unfortunate. She's always around. Like, they never even, you know, even Last Crusade puts Ilsa aside for a little while Indy's basically got to catch up to the Grail. Like, she gets out ahead of him.
Well, yeah, but that's also because she's not with them physically.
Right.
She has no purpose to be.
So, but she, you know, she's just always there. She's so annoying, and she's always around.
You know, I was actually more annoyed with Ilsa.
Really?
Honestly.
Well, it's because she's a Nazi.
Yeah, basically. You know, generally.
I wonder why that would be annoying. I think the other reason why this movie rubs me the wrong way now is I don't like the shock factor involved. This is a movie that was swinging for distance when it came to the crazy crap that they could get away with, to the point where they had to create a new rating. Like, this was the first film that was ever rated PG-13, because they saw this was not a PG movie, but it wasn't quite an R movie, so they had to create some whole new rating for it. And it's because, like, that's the thing. I watched this one when I was 9, and it freaked me the holy hell out.
I think to say that they were trying to be as visually offensive as possible is kind of a bit malignant to the integrity of all those involved in making the film. I think they were trying to honestly create something that they felt was substantial, and I personally think they did. But
I don't think, like, they never, even, okay, even if you play, all of these movies have one moment that really freaks you out. Like, all of these movies most of them have, like, a face melting. Actually, almost all of them have a face melting. I don't know why I just thought of that. You know, I think that there are ways to show me a scary voodoo doctor that does not have to rip a guy's heart out while it's still beating and show it to him. I really think there had to... That's I can't get around that, because every time I see that, and only, you know, when I was like 18 or 19 could I actually watch that, did I think, oh my god, you know, like, this is something that needs to be in this movie.
I'm starting to think there might have been something wrong with me as a child that
that
never
didn't affect you.
Me.
No, I knew a lot of kids that didn't affect them. That's on me. That's not on you.
Oh, okay.
That's on me. And as I look at it now, like, it's very obviously fake, right? Like, the fact that you don't see anything else, like, it's obviously a fake-looking torso, mm-hmm. and certainly not a real heart, but it's, you know, it works. It's very effective, but I'm like... Why was that? Why did we need to write that into the story? Why did we need to show that? Why did we need to take this very, very dark story and really push it into the darkness of the corner? That's my thing with this movie is it tries to do too much, and it's unfortunate because we were talking about action sequences before, and there are a few action sequences in this entire series that are as good as that mine car chase.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how that minecart chase never got turned into a ride at an amusement park somewhere, I do not know.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I there's just, it's all just started, as I've grown older, it's all just started to annoy me. I still enjoy it. I know I'm harping on it like crazy. I don't love it. I like it. And mm-hmm. there are things in it that do make me smile. But there's a lot of things in it that just make me cringe.
But it is not Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yes, it is.
No, it absolutely is not.
It.
Do you need me to teach you again why it is not?
I don't think we have time for that.
Probably,
because I think that's
not
a whole other show. But I everything that Kingdom of the Crystal Skull tries to do and fails, this movie tries to do and fails.
No, this movie tries to do and succeeds. You need to read that Matt Zoller Seitz article, because it puts it into a perspective.
I'm sure, this is me saying that both movies, to a certain degree, work.
Temple works, period.
They both work. I don't love either one of them. I like
them
both.
Crystal Skull does not work.
Sure it does.
No, it doesn't.
Sure
Crystal
it does.
Skull has moments that are believable. One very specifically and rather appropriately bringing up, you know, the various women of Indy's life.
Yeah.
When they're, you know, sitting in the van and they're outrunning the Russians and they're about to run into the giant man-eating ants.
Yeah.
That right there. It's a big
man-eating
problems.
Ants? You don't like man-eating ants?
No.
Sorry. Okay, wait a minute. Room full of bugs.
Yeah.
Fine. Man-eating ants? No, no.
Because the ants aren't real. CGI.
Oh, no, but now we're... No, that's a whole other argument.
You, that okay, is a whole
you mean
other
that they're
argument.
Not actually there. Not that they
no.
don't exist in this universe.
Both.
I think somewhere in the deepest jungle of somewhere that those kinds of ants exist.
Either way, there is the moment where they're talking and Marion says, well, why didn't you marry someone else? And da-da-da-da-da. And he
right.
says, and he looks at her and just says all perfect and indie and swoony.
Because she wasn't you.
Because they weren't you.
Yeah.
And that is indie. And that is probably one of the only moments that Spielberg actually got into the film that George Lucas didn't get his grubby little fat obnoxious fingers on. The entire thing is an abomination that Spielberg himself has admitted was basically a way
he's
to
admitted
placate.
That about, but he's admitted that about Temple, too.
No,
he's,
he hasn't.
Yes, he has. He has gone no. back about Temple and said, you know, I kind of wish we didn't do this. I kind of wish we didn't do this. And I kind of wish we did. He regrets like how devilish they make the Hindus look. He regrets how shrill the character of Willie Scott is and how far they went with this darkness. I figured this out like 5 minutes ago. Before 5 minutes before you got here.
But the big difference between the two is that that was a timely mistake that maybe he thinks he could have changed. And in hindsight, the screw-ups with Crystal Skull are purely because he was looking to stroke George Lucas.
Yeah.
That was it.
I still disagree, but we will be arguing for, like, literally we will be arguing for so long. I almost want to dedicate an entire show to that, but we're going to have to let it go. You know, I see your point. I'm not saying you're wrong. I have never been shy about that. I know you don't listen to the show, but I have never been shy about telling somebody that they're wrong. Just go ask Bob. You're not wrong. I disagree. But we're going to have to put a pin in that because we've got one more movie to get to, and we're going to get to that after this. For my choice of The Other Side, I actually chose a film that I had never seen before, also from 1984, directed by Robert Zemeckis. I went with Romancing the Stone, which is a film starring Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner and Danny DeVito, which I chose it because at the time, and still to a certain extent, it's seen as a weird stepbrother to Indiana Jones as a series. Like, you can see the Indiana Jones fingerprints all over this movie, like right down to the poster, certainly right down to the title.
They've got the same bones.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, it was a hit back in 1984. And it's kind of been... I don't want to say that it's been lost to time, but it's not the movie that you hear a lot of people bringing up anymore. It's one of these ones where the shine's been off the apple. This was a first watch for me. And I was actually kind of happy to see how well it's held up. You know, a lot of times... I've done series where I've gotten people to go back and watch 80s and 90s pop culture touchstones to see how they've aged.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the results are kind of mixed. Movies that you think hold up perfectly, not so much. Romancing the Stone has aged very well.
Very well.
You rewatched it for this.
Yeah.
And you said that you were coming away with stuff that you hadn't thought of the first time.
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, just with how progressive it is.
Okay.
In terms of gender politics and feminism.
In 84.
I mean, and I just, well...
And lest we forget, just to kind of put a point on this, because I think that we kind of forget this sometimes, because we like to think that we're living in... Like, we like to watch things like Mad Men and go, oh, how quaint, and oh, how backwards, and so on and so forth. And look at how dumb we were in the 50s and 60s. But lest we forget that in 1984, the idea of sexual harassment was still 7 years away. Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill, that was 1991. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Right? So, 1984,
sick.
We're we're just around the age of 9 to 5.
Yeah.
You know, where and we're still a few years away from movies like Working Girl. So yeah, so what you're saying is was ahead of its time, really.
And especially because it starts off and you've got, you know, this woman who writes these, you know, practically Harlequin romances, and she has a cat and she lives alone and everyone's trying to set her up because she's in her 30s and
single.
That biological clock is ticking because she's about to lose all, you know, relevance as a female when she ceases to be able to marry and reproduce.
Right.
We actually
forgetting
disappear.
The fact that she's a successful writer.
A fun fact, in Cambodia, beyond the age of 25, you're actually considered expired.
Wow.
Yeah, I learned that when I was there. So I'm technically expired. That's fun. But it starts with that kind of a notion. And she's obviously not having much of it, but she's a little flighty. But then she goes away, and even her sister is this horrible model for women,
mm-hmm.
who's, you know, married a man who is somehow nefariously involved in a drug cartel.
Yeah.
And women make bad decisions, especially with men. But she gets there, and then as soon as she meets, remind me of his name.
Jack Colton.
Jack Colton, thank
Jack
you.
Jack T. Colton.
Right. The T is important.
Yes.
As soon as she meets Jack T. Colton, everything kind of turns around. You realize that she actually has very few filters. She cares very little about what other people think of her. She's full of conviction, full of gumption, and learns quickly.
Yeah.
Starts wielding the machete and doing all sorts of things and drinking like a man and doing all sorts of things like a man and pulling her own weight. And I remember as a little girl watching this movie and thinking that she was somebody that I would love to be like.
Yeah.
Either as a writer or just as a woman, but I don't think I fully understood the depth of it. And then rewatching it this time, I'm at first kind of getting all, you know, my back up against a wall thinking, oh, this is so dated and so horrible for women, and then very quickly that opinion changed. I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Kind
yeah.
of that little click.
Yeah. You know what was crazy for me was, I don't know how this has happened, but Kathleen Turner, at like her career and her as an actress, has kind of been a thing that I know about more than I've actually experienced, because I didn't watch a lot of her movies growing up. So I, you know, like my Kathleen Turner touchstone is Jessica Rabbit.
Oh.
Right? Yeah, right. So this is, we could psychoanalyze that to the hills, I'm sure. But so this was probably my first experience of her, like when she was like an A-list star. And because afterwards, like I kind of started getting to her when she was more like, I guess, like into her mid to late 40s.
Right.
And she's playing a different type of role.
Yes.
And it's like, it's really, really crazy to see a lot of movie stars, both male and female, when they're kind of in their prime. I thought the same sort of thing the first time I watched The Apartment and I saw Jack Lemmon, like as a young man,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I almost want to say that this was one of the first times that I kind of got Kathleen Turner. And I kind of want to like go back and watch a whole bunch of Kathleen Turner movies now.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, what is in the flask?
Bourbon.
Awesome. Right from the very beginning, like when she's playing this I don't even know what the heck to call her, but Miss Lonely Hearts, let's call her. I'm basically living alone with a cat, you know, leaving herself post-it notes to do things. I'm looking at it, and like this is my first time seeing like Kathleen Turner at that age. I was like, I don't believe this for a second. This is the girl in the beginning of the teen movie with her hair in the ponytail and the glasses who's going to be the really hot chick at the end.
Yeah.
I'm like, you gotta be kidding. I gotta be honest. I came away from this movie and I was like, I want to switch these casts. I want to put her in Temple of Doom and put Kate Capshaw in this movie.
Because there's something, and that inherently is, I mean, not a sexist perspective, but it's an appropriate perspective.
No,
as
how they would embody the cross characters. I have a hunch if I had Kathleen Turner playing Willie Scott, that she would not annoy me nearly as much. I also have the hunch that if I had Kate Capshaw playing Joan Wilder, that I would not like this movie nearly as much.
No, you wouldn't have. But
right.
the issue, your issue with Temple of Doom is less Kate Capshaw, more Willie Scott. It's about the character.
It's really both.
If anybody had played her that wasn't her, you would have hated them just as much because the character was grating. It doesn't matter who plays her. It's the person. It's the character that bothers
you. I think it's both.
I don't.
But there's a difference. I disagree,
but I also digress.
Okay.
That is...
You're right.
We shall agree to disagree.
We talked about this before. The other thing we get here, and something that I thought that I came away with from Romancing the Stone that I realized, is... So we got Michael Douglas as Jack T. Coulson. Here we have another scoundrel. Mm-hmm. But he's not quite as good a scoundrel as Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones.
Though.
No, he's not bad. You know? Like, he's...
And do him too.
Yeah. I don't know that I would. He's a wise ass. Like, he is cut... Like, you can see that they want him to be kind of Indiana Jones-esque, but he strikes me more as the kind of roles at this era that Kurt Russell was playing. Like, he strikes me more as Snake Plissken and as what's-his-name from Big Trouble in Little China. You know, where he's more a wise ass than he is an actual scoundrel.
Well, I think he's a bit of both. I could actually see him. I think you could compare him to Solo. I think he's a bit more of a Han Solo.
I don't think he's as badass.
Well, nobody's as badass. Nobody's Indy. Nobody will be Indy other than Harrison.
No, but again, I think that. Well, and it's probably because he's the same guy. I think that Han Solo's close.
Yep.
Right, but he's you could see that Zemeckis and Diane Thomas, who wrote this movie, want him to be in certain respect. They also, of course, the other thing I like is that they obviously want him to be the kind of character that she was writing. You know, they want him to be the embodiment of the characters that Joan Wilder was writing, but you know, far more genuine.
There's even a throwaway line, and I can't quite remember exactly what it is, but it's when they're in the plane and they're burning the pot.
Yeah.
And he says something about Jesse. Like about, you know, oh, well, something about not being like if... Something about surprising her if she had... About how she writes her men. And
okay.
He mentions Jesse specifically, who is the male character in all of her books.
The faceless male that we never...
The faceless love interest who rides in and saves the day or helps her save the day. And they live happily ever after.
That surprised me. Thank you for reminding me. That the female novelist who's writing these books, obviously, like, very much for a female audience, that her male character would be faceless. And you see that, like, in the covers of the books, his face is always in shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I get that there's a mystery to that, and then the mystery is alluring and enticing and all that jazz. But, pardon me for being presumptuous, but I would think that the face would be important.
No.
Not so much?
No. And because it's...
I'm learning tonight. This is great.
Well, it's... and this is something that, even when I was really little, I always took away from it, which is a little strange, I guess. But there is... It's almost like Apple's marketing strategy.
Okay.
Facelessness implies applicability. There is something to be said for not having a very explicit description.
Okay.
Because then you can place yourself in it. And that's also why, when you think about it, you don't really see the heroine's face either in the opening sequence. Her face is...
You see it eventually.
Not in full.
You do.
Nope. Never in full. Never.
But we get there.
No, you don't.
Okay, I've only seen it the one time, so I'm not going to argue that. But
check it out again.
The other thing that I loved about this movie, and I swear, like, I saw most of this movie coming. Like, it's not exactly a complicated plot.
No.
But the one thing I certainly didn't see coming, and easily my favorite thing of the whole damn movie, is it is a stroke of genius to have the drug lord be a fan of Joan Wilder's books.
Yeah.
I laughed myself stupid at, you know, Wayne Wilder? Oh, I read your books. Hey, everybody. Then he says something in Spanish, which is probably complete horseshit. To like, oh, and they're like, oh, yeah, you know.
It's Juanita.
Juanita Wilder?
It's
yes.
Juanita Wilder.
Yeah.
Juanita.
Played by the guy from Three Amigos. Played by Three Amigos. I laughed myself stupid. When that came up.
Oh,
that
no, it's
that
hilarious.
Was, that was
and
awesome.
Then all of a sudden they're all like sheepish and so happy to see her, it just changes
everything. And sure enough, like he goes inside, he's got like the row of her books. Mm-hmm. That was crazy. Probably my ultimate takeaway from this movie, from the first time I watched it and just in general, is how far chemistry between leads will carry a film. Because they did a few of these. Like, they did another one of these, and they did War of the Roses later, and I think I'm probably forgetting one or two other movies that Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner did together. And, you know, they just, for whatever, they're kind of short on the characters of Jack Colson and Juanita. they together as actors are just friggin' perfect.
Oh, yeah, they're phenomenal.
You know, and I've gone through that a few times with recent movies. Like, one that comes to mind, which is not really great, but I went with it with the chemistry, was... did you see The Adjustment Bureau?
No.
Okay. It's just okay. Like, it's not a kind of movie I think you need to go out and see.
Yeah.
But the chemistry between Emily Blunt and Matt Damon in that movie is fan-friggin-tastic. Mm. So... And you get that here. Like, and that's... I think that's the kind of thing you get with all the great movie couples, is that ineffable chemistry between them... that you sometimes don't even see coming,
mm-hmm.
right? And sometimes it's spawned by things going on off screen, like, you know, even right now with Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield, you know, that's what's fueling them. But sometimes it's completely unrelated, and that was the one thing I came away with from this movie,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, was not there in Temple of Doom.
I'm gonna choose not to react to that one.
All right. Well, in that case, we will call it a day for episode 112 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, June the 9th for episode 113. We're going to go a little bit off book, and we're going to discuss Blue Ruin. Ariel's work can be found at arielfisher.com, also sometimes at row3.com and roomorg.com. Do you have anything coming up next week that people can look forward to? And you're going to correct me on something.
Well, mostly on Roomorg, like in the magazine.
Oh, in print.
Online.
Oh,
yes.
My.
In
Look
print.
At you. Wow.
I know.
You are officially my hero after tonight, by the way.
Oh.
So, you know.
Thanks.
Like, this has been awesome. Seriously.
Aw. That's so nice. Thank you.
Anything coming up next week that people can look forward to? Anything, you got anything planned? Anything in the hopper? You're going to write about X-Men, obviously.
Well, yes. When I finally get to, you know, ingest it.
See it with us lowly plebes.
Yes. Lowly plebes.
Where can people find you on Twitter?
People can find me at AFIS8, that's at AFIS8 on Twitter.
Very nice. My site is thematinee.ca. For more audio content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them, as I mentioned, on soundcloud.com/matineecast, Stitcher Radio, Blueberry, and Apple's podcasting app, and of course the iTunes Store. Everything gives you handy ways to subscribe and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Raiders of the Lost Ark, The Temple of Doom, Romancing the Stone, or the summer indies that you want to see can be left in the comment section of the site. Emails to ryan@thematinee.ca or Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca. There's also Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Ariel Fisher, any final thoughts?
This has been fun.
Good. We'll get you back. For Ariel, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.